I was actually speaking at a grade school about 5 years ago in central Illinois, not far from you. And the teacher, I knew her not real well, but I'd spoken to her class 3 or 4 years in a row. On this particular day, I was talking about my father to the class because we were talking about Playing with the Enemy, my first book, which is about my father. And I looked to the back and she was crying. And so after class, I walked over to her, asked her why she's crying. And she says, oh, my father was just diagnosed with lung cancer. He's dying. And she says, I'm so angry at him. Well, I thought the anger was because he was dying. And through the course of the conversation, I found out that she felt that he was really an embarrassment to the family. They were in a small town. Everybody knew him. He was an alcoholic. He was a hoarder. And about 2 days later, I got a letter from her. She said she did not talk to him and he had just passed away. There's a lot of people walking around that kind of harbor anger towards their parents that is never resolved. You know, I thought, well, this is a book that will help, you know, help people. And it's a work of fiction, it's entertainment, but it'll also help people resolve these issues. And Judy, I'll tell you, in the last 6 weeks, I've received over 100 emails, letters, phone calls from people who, some of them weeping, saying that they wish they would have read this book before their parent died, or they're grateful that they read this book before their parents died.
Your first book was about your own father, and it was a work of nonfiction.
Yes.
How is it different writing a book of fiction? What are the major differences for the writer, other than one is true and one is, of course, imagined?
Nonfiction, I find more difficult because it's so important to get the details correct, because you can have everything right, and you can have a date wrong, and somebody will find that, and they will just pick you apart. And so, you know, writing for me, I'm writing another nonfiction book right now. The attention to detail just has to be perfect. When you're writing fiction, your mind is free to create and to take the story where you'd like it to go, and not necessarily where it does go. I enjoy the research that goes with writing a true story, but I love the freedom that writing fiction gives you.
Well, it's one thing to write a nonfiction book about your father. It's another to write about someone who is very well known or somewhat of a celebrity. And you also did that. You wrote a book called Hey Buddy about Buddy Holly, the pop singer. How is that different?
That was different because so much of what is in Hey Buddy, because you're talking about a musical artist, it becomes subjective. What you think of their music, what their music conveys, what you believe it feels. That part of it is fascinating because on the same day, you'll get an email from somebody who tells you you were absolutely dead wrong, and you'll get a letter from somebody who says you were spot on, you hit it exactly right. And so even though it is a true story, so much of it is subjective that it's almost, in some ways, it has the feel of writing fiction. Hey Buddy, the thing that book did, though, which is interesting, I'm also a pilot, and I worked with the NTSB to recreate the fatal crash that killed Buddy Holly, you know, the Big Bopper and Ritchie Valens, which became known as the day the music died. And we have really, the NTSB says we have written the most accurate depiction of the crash.
It's almost as if it's an investigative piece as well.
It is. And it wasn't intended to be that way. When I started writing about Hey Buddy, one of the things I said I wasn't going to do is I wasn't going to write about the crash, because there's so many myths and so many falsehoods that have been perpetuated through the years about what happened that crash. But as I started writing the story, I realized that, you know, it was a very, very important piece that had been mishandled since 1959. And so I contacted the NTSB, got in touch with one of their crash experts that had just retired and was looking for something to do.
What did you find out about that crash that had not been in the public eye before?
Yeah, through the years, there was a lot of speculation that the autopilot wasn't working and that the pilot basically just flew the plane to the ground and wasn't aware. And we really found out that just was not true. The last 5 minutes of that flight would have been pure terror, because that plane was totally out of control. And we were able to show, because of the way the debris landed on the ground, how the plane kind of tumbled out of the sky. And the reason for the crash was really simple. It was an inexperienced, non-qualified pilot.
Right, a 21-year-old pilot, if I recall.
Yeah, in a very high-performance airplane in terrible weather. He had actually, a few months before, had failed his exam for flying instruments, and he was flying on instruments that night.
Any understanding as to why Buddy Holly and Ritchie Valens and the Big Bopper climbed on board this plane? Did they have no idea that the pilot was so inexperienced?
They didn't know. They were on a bus traveling through the Midwest. The weather outside was 20 below zero. And so Buddy rented the plane through a charter service. And if you call a charter service, most people would reasonably expect that the government has chartered this as a legal entity, that it's probably going to be safe. And he chartered it for his band members. But Ritchie Valens had never flown in a small plane, and he begged Waylon Jennings, of all people, who was traveling with Buddy Holly, to take his place, and so Waylon gave up his seat so Ritchie Valens could fly, and the Big Bopper had the flu, and he was wanting to get to the destination early so that he could see a doctor and get some medication, and so he flipped a coin with Tommy Alsop, who was one of the guitar players, and Tommy lost the flip, and Big Bopper climbed on the plane.
Well, and what a tragedy, what a tragedy.
Yes. Yes.
Getting back to your nonfiction book about your father, it has to do with him being a prospect for the Brooklyn Dodgers professional baseball team and then signing up for World War II after Pearl Harbor and being assigned to guard German prisoners of war.
Yes.
And the story takes off from there.
He was more than a prospect. He was signed by the Brooklyn Dodgers when he was 15 years old in the summer of 1941. He spent half of the season in the farm system, became Rookie of the Year at 15 years old. When the season ended, of course, Pearl Harbor was bombed in December, and so minor league baseball, as we knew it, ended. And my father, who was only 15 years old, the Dodgers actually asked his father to lie for him, say he was 17, which his father did, signed a document saying he was 17, and he was enlisted in the Navy, where he became the catcher of a touring baseball team that toured North Africa to entertain the troops. As the war was winding down in North Africa, they sent the baseball team home, and they really had no duty, but the Navy had captured the German U-boat, the U-505, which is actually housed at the Museum of Science and Industry today. And because the capture was held top secret, they had to hide the prisoners. And the only able-bodied men that weren't at war in the Navy were this baseball team. So they were sent to Ruston, Louisiana, where they guarded those prisoners. And through the course of their confinement, they taught them to play baseball.
And that now will be made into a film.
Yes, it is. It's slated to film next July.
Many nonfiction writers and novelists dream of having their book turned into a film. How is it that yours was chosen for this? What was the process?
Originally, the person who optioned the film was Gerald Mullen. He was Academy Award-winning producer of Schindler's List. But Gerald ended up having a breakup with his partnership. He ended up losing the property in a lawsuit. And so Playing with the Enemy's been kind of bouncing around Hollywood for a while. But CinemaFund Capital Logistics through Positivity Pictures is going to make it, and we start next July.
How much control do you have when your book is optioned like that, whether it's nonfiction or a novel?
Very little. Most of the authors that I know that have had their movies made, none of them are happy. You know, they've written the story to be a certain way. They want it to be a certain way. With Playing with the Enemy, they have been very, very good to me, very, very fair to me, because they know it's about my father, and so it's a highly sensitive subject to me. They are taking creative liberties. There's some things that are a little different from the book, but for the most part, it's been a very fair process, which most people tell me that their experience is that it's not.
You are also a motivational speaker. What are some of the topics you tackle there?
I talk to kids, mostly high school, college students. We talk about the fact that there's only two things you can control in your life, which is your attitude and your effort. You can't control the weather. You can't control what other people do, but you can control situations and how you feel about them and how hard you work. Most of what I speak of works around that framework.
We've been talking with Gary Moore. He is a novelist and nonfiction writer. He will be reading from his latest book, The Final Service, this evening at Barnes & Noble in Bloomington. Thank you so much for talking with us.
Judy, thank you. It's a real pleasure.
I'm Judy Valente.